Pray. God of power, God of hope, please be with me and with all of us as we search for your life-giving ways in these old and new words. Amen. In the lectionary readings that we follow, we get two segments from the story of Joseph. The one from last week where we heard about the conflict between the brothers which resulted in the selling of Joseph into slavery. And then the text from this week that Chaba read for us about the brothers' reconciliation. But these are just two small sections from a much larger tale. At 450 verses, it is the longest connected narrative in the book of Genesis. Indeed, in the entire Hebrew Bible, only Moses and David are given more space. It can be seen as a self-contained literary unit that stands alone as just a really compelling story. But it also serves an important purpose in the wider biblical narrative, providing a bridge between the stories of creation and the patriarchs, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, and the Exodus, the foundational Jewish story of liberation from Pharaoh's clutches. The Joseph story explains how the people got from their promised land into Egypt. But it also contains a stark message about how God's people ought to relate to worldly power. And as we don't spend much time with Joseph in our readings, and the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical only gets us so far, let's do a quick recap of the story. Joseph, the firstborn of Jacob's favored wife, Rachel, is treated like the golden child by his father, who famously gives him a long-sleeved robe that arouses his brother's jealousy. Naive Joseph seems to flaunt this favoritism by telling about the dreams that he has about his dominance over them. This does not go over well with his brothers, and they decide to sell him into slavery. Joseph ends up in Egypt, where he secures a post with Pharaoh's captain of the guard. But that doesn't go well for him when he rebuffs the guard's wife's advances and he ends up in jail. He's there for a time, but then wins his freedom because of his skills in dream interpretation, specifically the interpretation of one of Pharaoh's dreams, where he predicted that the empire would first encounter 7 years of abundance and then 7 years of famine. Joseph counsels Pharaoh that food should be stored up in the years of abundance and then sold in the years of famine. Good advice. And then in a quintessential rags-to-riches moment, Pharaoh gives Joseph authority over all of his affairs, and he becomes lord of all the land of Egypt. Things come to pass as Joseph predicted, and at his direction, stocks are stored away. When the lean times hit, Pharaoh's storehouses are full, and the food is sold back to the people. Now, the famine was so widespread that it forced Joseph's brothers to travel from Canaan to Egypt to get some necessary supplies. Joseph had changed much since his brothers left him in a pit, and when they came to settle their accounts, they did not recognize him. But rather than revealing his true identity right away, Joseph put his brothers through a series of tests and low-grade emotional torture. And it is only after he blackmailed them into bringing his little brother Benjamin to Egypt that he unmasks his royal disguise and reveals himself as their long-lost brother. It is here, as Chaba read for us, where he claims that God's power is behind the whole sequence of events. "It was not you," Joseph says, "who sent me here, but God. God has made me the father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler of the land of Egypt." This is a stunning theological claim, especially considering that God is basically absent from the entire Joseph narrative. We have Joseph's presumption of divine authority, but as opposed to the mighty sweep of creation at the beginning of Genesis and God's liberating works in Exodus, in this story, God is not heard from at all. By the biblical account, this is primarily a secular story, with the primary motivators of the protagonists being hate and jealousy, fear and self-advancement. Joseph himself, gifted with the ability to interpret dreams, used that gift to better himself and the empire that he served. While he was certainly prudent to store up food in the time of abundance, he did not share his insight with any beside Pharaoh. When the hungry poor were at the door and could no longer pay for the food that Joseph had stored away, they were forced to sell their land and move into the cities, and they became servants of the empire. Joseph's gift of dream interpretation and the warning of impending famine was ultimately used to amass more wealth and power for the already wealthy and powerful. With perspective, we see that the astounding success of Joseph in Egypt emerges as the precursor to the enslavement of his descendants. But for Joseph, feeding well at the imperial table, he equated his success with God's will. Like countless monarchs and their agents over the centuries, Joseph insisted that his authority had divine support. He was not the first and certainly not the last to conflate God's will with worldly power and wealth. Consider these examples from our own tradition. Constantine, stabilizing his power by the adoption of Christianity as the religion of the empire. Charlemagne, using mass baptisms without consent to envelop swaths of Europe into his realm. The doctrine of discovery and the church-supported takeover of indigenous land by colonial interests. The prosperity gospelers who equate financial success with God's grace. Again and again, when God's will gets conflated with wealth and power, religion becomes just another tool of empire. In January 2016, Donald Trump gave a campaign speech at a small Christian college in Sioux Center, Iowa. Instantly, the speech became famous for this line. "I have the most loyal people. I could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I wouldn't lose any voters." As monumentally disturbing as that statement was, as Christians, perhaps what he went on to say in that speech should be equally as alarming. Standing in front of a three-story pipe organ, Mr. Trump said, "I will tell you, Christianity is under tremendous siege. Christians make up the majority of the country, and yet we don't exert the power that we should." He then raised a finger to emphasize his next words. "Christianity will have power," he said. "If I'm there in the White House, you're going to have plenty of power. You don't need anybody else but me." The quest for power, as envisioned by Mr. Trump in that statement, is a zero-sum game. It separates the winners from the losers, the insiders from the outsiders, who's in and who's out. It's a game we all play, whether we are conscious of it or not. It is embedded into our systems, our politics, our very culture. And this gatekeeping of who's in and who's out is certainly not new. In the time of Jesus, the Canaanites and Jews were ancient enemies. Conflicting claims over the land had raged for centuries. Different cultures and practices and religions, these were groups who did not get along. And so when a Canaanite woman no less, came up to Jesus and started shouting at him, "Have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is tormented by a demon." The reaction from the disciples was understandable. "Send her away," they said. "Send her away, for she keeps shouting at us." What then follows is one of the most remarkable interactions in all of the Gospels. Remarkable for its content, but perhaps more remarkable for the fact that it was recorded by the gospel writers at all, for it does not show Jesus in a positive light. "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel," he tells the woman. But she came and knelt before him, saying, "Lord, help me." He answered, "It is not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." She said, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Maybe he was tired or distracted or hangry, but whatever the circumstance, there is no denying that Jesus called the woman a dog and fully intended to ignore her need. It may be jarring to hear, but it is also a clear reminder of Jesus' full humanity. He fell into the trap we all fall into from time to time, the trap of power, when we put ourselves in the position of gatekeeper, determining who's in and who's out. Jesus' preference for his own tribe, his prejudice against outsiders, came through in this moment. But the Canaanite woman does not have any time for any cultural or historical baggage. Her daughter needs help and needs help now. She is desperate. And so she doesn't make an appointment or send a calendar invite. She runs right up to him. She doesn't ask politely, "Please, sir, when you have a moment." No, she shouts at him, "Lord, help me." And when Jesus reveals his prejudice, her words are sharp. "Yes, Lord, but even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table." Her need is visceral. Her urgency is unavoidable. And then something changes inside Jesus. He can tell he's going the wrong direction. Perhaps her deep hunger for healing reminded him of a time in his own life when he was hungry, of his pilgrimage in the desert after his baptism, of being alone and famished and tempted in the wilderness, of finding clarity of purpose, of knowing the urgency of mission, of then walking boldly into the synagogue, opening the scroll of Isaiah and reading these words, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to bring good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release of the captives and recovery of sight to the blind and to let the oppressed go free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Perhaps the Canaanite woman's cries reminded him of his purpose, his mission to go to the poor, the oppressed, the excluded, the despised, and offer them hope and bring them healing. The central pillar of our faith is that in Jesus, humanity and divinity are both wholly expressed. In Jesus, as exemplified in this interaction with the Canaanite woman, we see both our capacity to make mistakes and our ability to learn from them, to grow, to evolve, to change direction. And in him, we also see God's true mission, not just for Jesus, but for all of God's children. God's will is not to make the rich richer on the backs of the poor, to make the powerful more powerful through the oppression of the vulnerable. God's will is that those in power stand in solidarity with those who are hurting and hungry and oppressed. God's work is to bring hope and healing to the world. Last week, there was a loud knock at the door of the church. There was a man there asking for help, and so I went out to speak with him. And he was very animated, sometimes yelling at me, and he pointed to the church and said, "You in the church, you've got so much wealth. You should be doing more to help the poor. There are people baking in the sun on the streets, and I need some water to give to them." I got him a case of water bottles and told him about our Wednesday hospitality tent in the park. But by then I was late for a Zoom call, and so I told him that I had to go. He walked to the streets with the water, and I headed down to my air-conditioned office. His words were sharp, and they have been biting into me ever since. In that situation, I was the one who held the power. I was the one with authority, a gatekeeper to the church's resources. But I now know that in his cries and through his actions, he was the one doing God's work. The great temptation of religion is to intertwine itself with empire, to equate money and power and comfort and authority with God's will. As we see in the Joseph story, this has always been and will always be the path to enslavement, the gorging on the food that never satisfies, the surrender of our lives to the despots of temptation and lies. As followers of Jesus, we are called to choose a different way, to recognize our mistakes and to evolve, to go to the poor, the oppressed, the excluded, and the despised, to preach inclusion, to spread kindness, to do justice, and most importantly, to reject the temptation of empire and to be bound by a higher authority. On June 1st of this year, amid the George Floyd protests in Washington, D.C., law enforcement officers used tear gas to forcefully clear protesters and clear a path for President Donald Trump to do a photo op in front of St. John's Episcopal Church while holding a Bible. I end now with these words of response to that act by Bishop Marianne Buddy of the Episcopal Diocese of Washington. Our faith has many things to say because it speaks to every dimension of the human experience. Our texts would offer words of encouragement to those who are striving for justice. Jesus himself spoke of bringing the kingdom of God, God's shalom and universal love to the human experience. The Bible speaks of God's demand for us to walk humbly and to do justice and to love the neighbor. And all of these things point us to saying that God stands with those who are suffering, God walks with those who are oppressed, and God also has harsh things to say to those of us with privilege and power who use that power to be instruments of oppression for others. For those in any kind of authority, we hear ourselves held in check by a higher authority.